when it was first about to be published, I worried about how many children it would kill, you know, how many, not because it gave definitely the wrong advice, but any kind of advice can be misunderstood, and I was always trying to lean in the direction of reassuring parents. Anyway, I was very pleased that after 30 million copies have been sold and used, that nobody's accused me of having killed their child. The accusations that it corrupts youth, that didn't come until 22 years after it was published, and that came as a reaction to my opposition to the war in Vietnam. And in 64, I was asked by Lyndon Johnson's campaign committee to support him on radio and television. And I said I certainly would, because Lyndon Johnson promised in that campaign he would not send American boys to fight in an Asian war. Those were his words. Whereas Barry Goldwater was threatening destruction of Vietnam, just wipe it off the face of the earth. So I said, certainly I'll support him as a citizen and as a pediatrician and as a spokesman for the disarmament movement. And I did enough so that he called me up 2 days after the election to thank me. And he said, Dr. Spock, I hope I prove worthy of your trust. And I had no idea. I had no idea that he'd prove utterly unworthy of my trust as far as Vietnam was concerned. And, well, you see, I'd been a liberal Democrat from the time I was in medical school until the Vietnam War began. But those experiences radicalized me. I realized our government and its foreign policy is more often than not aggressive, that it's trying to extend the power of our armed services or trying to extend the markets of our industries. In other words, it's the government is not working as much for the welfare of the American people as it's working for industry and for its own power. So I became a radical, and I became a socialist, and then
famous Dr. Benjamin Spock is with us tonight on Alternative Views. October of 1982, we had the great privilege of interviewing Dr. Benjamin Spock, one of the world's truly great people. That interview is as relevant today as it was back then. But before we have our interview with the author of Baby and Child Care, here are some news stories which we have gleaned recently from the alternative press.
The extra copy of July and August is mostly about Rush Limbaugh and all the lies that he's been vomiting on the American people all these years. But there is a small little article written by the editor of Extra, and it's about the single-payer health plan, such as they have up in Canada. He said the mainstream media have just been dismissing this plan, even though it's been introduced in Congress. The McDermott-Wellstone single-player proposal is there. The mainstream media say, well, it's politically unrealistic, and they're not even talking about it. But the people in FAIR, the Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, have examples, both personal and corporate, which show how the single-payer system would actually benefit the American people. Using them as an example, for instance, the company last year, FAIR, paid over $39,000 in medical premiums for their private insurance company to cover 10 employees. But because these insurance premiums have risen so much in the past few years, they can't afford to cover half-time employees. But under the single-payer national health insurance plan, FAIR would pay no private premiums, but instead a 4% tax on their total payroll of $307,000. Now, this health tax would have amounted to $12,280. So that means that they would have saved $26,975 last year because they paid $39,000 in premiums, whereas the tax for the single-payer system would have been a little over $12,000. And then the editor says his family of three paid $732 in 1973 to medical practitioners, deductibles, co-payments, and costs not covered by insurance. $732. But if they'd had the single-payer system with a 2.1% income tax to finance it, the tax would have come to $495 compared to the $732 they paid in all these non-covered costs. And the publisher who gave birth in 1993, her family of three paid out more than $2,000 in deductibles, co-payments, and uncovered costs. But under the single-payer plan, they would have had to pay only $585 in tax. So the mathematics is there. The single-payer system is much better for the total American people, but it's not good for the insurance companies, and they're the people who buy the politicians.
Frank, there's an analysis, a post-mortem, actually, of the failure of the Clinton health care reform program to make it through Congress in these times on September the 5th that basically criticizes Clinton for failing to have a better program and selling it to the American people, and in particular, Clinton himself failing to pick up on something like a single payer plan that would guarantee to every American good health insurance and that would pay for it through some sort of public taxation or financing. Clinton's failure to really come up with a good plan was what was responsible, according to David Moberg, for the failure. He indicated that there really was a climate where health care reform could have gone through, that no one initially indicated that there was not a health care crisis. Everyone saw that this was an appalling system where large numbers of people are not covered by health care in this country, where there's out-of-control costs with hospitalization and doctor's fees and insurance fees are getting out of control. Everyone realized something needed to be done. Moreover, there seemed to be the political climate and will to actually do something about it. Harris Wofford made health care reform the central issue of his 1991 Pennsylvania Senate race and engineered a stunning upset. He won against great odds because he said health care is the key issue and he was going to work for that to guarantee the American people health care programs. And initially, no one was really attacking Clinton's program except for some small business people and some right-wing ideologues. But Clinton never really developed a good program that could be sold to the American people. None of the grassroots activist groups that were going for health care reform could embrace Clinton's program. One, they didn't know what it was because it was done by his wife and others behind closed doors, and it was just too complex and esoteric to really explain to the American people, mainly because Clinton didn't want to offend the insurance lobbies and the American Medical Association and the other groups in the medical lobbies, and just basically dropped the ball, and the opponents were able to organize against it and thus defeat his program. And now it's not clear that we'll have any health care reform.
Here's just a wee insight into how the system works when it comes to pressuring Congress and the media to toe the line and to not bring out the other proposal, which is so popular with Americans and is actually working very well up in Canada, the single-payer system. Extra reports that Cokie Roberts, who's a biggie on NPR and ABC, she received a reported $20,000 for a speech which she gave to the Group Health Association of America, which is an alliance of HMOs. $20,000 for a little speech. How many of you make that much in a year? And then CBS News star Leslie Stahl received close to $20,000 for moderating a 90-minute panel discussion for the Healthcare Leadership Council, which is an alliance of insurance, drug companies, and HMOs. So these boys know how to play. They know how to play the Congress. They know how to play the media. Make sure that everything goes right.
Labels That Lie. That's the title of an article by Ben Lilliston in the 1993 Multinational Monitor magazine, where U.S.-based multinational pharmaceutical companies that peddle drugs to third world countries often fail to provide the correct information that physicians need to administer these drugs safely and effectively to their people. Congressional Office of Technology Assessment, or the OTA, did some examinations of these labeling practices. According to the OTA's discoveries, two-thirds of a random sample of 241 drugs that are marketed by U.S.-based multinational pharmaceuticals failed to provide appropriate medical information to these third world country physicians. The OTA evaluated the medical appropriateness of drug labeling in four countries: Brazil, Kenya, Panama, and Thailand. Typical of the problems found by the OTA were the following. The first, a synthetic version of the male hormone testosterone, was recommended for treating women for frigidity and benign breast conditions. It was also used to suppress production of breast milk and to relieve menopausal symptoms. The company provided inadequate evidence that the drug is effective for these conditions, and the label failed to warn about its serious side effects on this potentially dangerous drug. A second finding was that a drug for relief of pain and inflammation was recommended for a number of minor ailments, such as headaches, without mentioning potential side effects of the drug, including the complete shutdown of the body's production of white blood cells, and this could lead to fatal complications. Okay. This drug is no longer on the U.S. market.
It's very interesting that they would have this article, because about 9 or 10 years ago, there was an article in the left press which indicated that this was extremely rampant, and that there are so many drugs that are illegal and harmful in the United States, they are being shipped overseas where third world countries are actually using these things. And it was called the corporate crime of the century.
A third finding of the OTA was of a label of a magnesium-containing antacid, which instructed the user to regularly add the product to an infant formula, and this was used to prevent milk from souring and from forming curds in the baby's stomach. It was also used to aid digestion and to prevent constipation in healthy babies. The company provided no evidence to support these uses, and the labeling did not warn of the danger of magnesium overdose in the children. The OTA study did not identify the drugs or drug companies involved in the study by name. Representative Henry Waxman, who is a Democrat from California, and Senator Edward Kennedy, who is a Democrat from Massachusetts, released the OTA's findings in May. They both asserted that a listing of the drug products and the countries of sale should now be made available to the public.
In These Times has an article in the September 6th issue that talks about how corporate America is playing a bigger and bigger role in trying to influence the political process and intervening with new grassroots strategies to try to control the political environment even more than they have in the past. They indicated that recently IBM Vice Chairman Paul Rizzo wrote a letter to the company's 110,000 employees urging them to join a grassroots campaign to defeat the Democrats' health care program. Previously, IBM had stayed out of politics and certainly hadn't involved themselves in a corporate level where they try to organize their employees to take a certain political stand. But this is the new corporate strategy, according to In These Times. There was a recent conference, an annual Back to Grassroots meeting, that was organized by the Public Relations Council, which is an influential network of corporate public affairs officers that were trying to persuade corporations on the need to get involved in the political process, to organize their employees, to reward their employees for getting more involved in grassroots politics. The first aim of this program, according to the article, was for the corporate indoctrination to take place of all the employees. Actually, this has been going on for some time in some corporations. I once lived next to an executive for AT&T who was constantly being taken to these different, basically, indoctrination meetings or camps where they'd read all this right-wing literature and all the management and employees were indoctrinated as to what politicians or policies they should support, what their political thinking should be, and the like. But now the corporations are trying to organize not just their managers to indoctrinate them, but all the way through the different echelons of the corporation. Secondly, they're engaged in this corporate Leninist strategy where they're organizing cadres, small numbers of corporate employees who will infiltrate grassroots organizations and try to push them to supporting the policies that the corporation wants supported. And then they also have a key contact program where corporate employees will connect themselves with politicians, keep in touch with them, pressure them, etc. Previously, on the higher corporate levels, the corporation presidents would give money to politicians and there'd be corporate lobbying, but they're now trying to encourage their middle and other level echelon employees to involve themselves in grassroots activisms as soldiers, this is a quote, whose loyalty is essential for victory in today's competitive environment. And these corporations were told to reward their employees who are successful grassroots activists. So watch out, because the corporations may more and more try to influence public opinion on every level, from local elections and local issues to national ones, through this new corporate strategy.
And now for our interview with Dr. Spock. How many of you in the audience have been touched some way or another, directly or indirectly, by Dr. Spock? Now, Doug, you were a Dr. Spock baby, and I raised my children with Dr. Spock, and no telling how many millions and millions of others all around the country. His famous book ran in 25 million copies, I believe it was, and is translated into 25 different languages. Well, Dr. Spock is going to be with us tonight on Alternative Views. And also, a lot of maybe not very well-known aspects about Dr. Spock. I think you'll find it fascinating.
Yeah, there are few people in the world, or even world history, that you can just say their last names and you'll know automatically who they are. You don't need any more. They're that statue. You know, you think of Einstein and Freud and Dr. Spock. How many of you folks out there either raised your children in the Spockian manner or were raised in such a way? Millions and millions. But Dr. Spock is a significant person in the history of the United States, right, Doug? Not only in child care, but in other fields.
Dr. Spock has been active in anti-nuclear groups like SANE for many years. He was a prominent spokesperson for the Vietnam War. He's one of the first anti-war spokespersons I heard when I was a student at Columbia University, and has continued to be politically active through the years. We want to discuss all of these things with him, but we thought we'd start off with discussing your theories of childcare, which is what got you famous and made you a personality, a national figure in the first place. Could you reflect a little bit on your book that you published first in 1946? It's called Baby and Childcare and has gone through several editions. How did your theory of childcare differ from more traditional theories, and over the years, how have you modified that?
That's quite an order. I never thought of it as a theory. I can tell you where I got my ideas. In the first place, I was brought up very sternly and strictly by a New England couple, especially my fiercely moralistic mother. And though some people have said, I suppose this book is a protest against the way you were brought up, well, that's only about a third of it. I think that my interest in children, devotion to children, and those of my sisters and brother were all because my mother was totally devoted to her children. So I think that's part of where I got launched from. I cared a lot about children, but I think I also thought there must be easier ways, more pleasant ways to bring up children than the rather severe, oppressive way that my mother used. I had pediatric training after medical school, and then I thought, I've got to get some psychological training. No other pediatrician had gotten that and stayed in pediatrics, so I found there was no place to get this training, so I took a year's residency in psychiatry at New York Hospital. That was occupied taking care of patients with schizophrenia and manic depressive psychosis. This gave me nothing with which to answer mother's questions about thumb sucking and toilet training and resistance to weaning. But I did discover during that year's residency that it was the psychoanalytically trained people who were able to make the discussion of patients' stories dynamic. So I said, I want psychoanalytic training. So that year that I started pediatric practice in New York, at the bottom of the Depression in 1933, I started in my own personal analysis, and then for 5 years took seminars at the New York Psychoanalytic Institute. This explains my Freudian, my basically Freudian concepts. And actually, anyone who knows Freud, reading through Baby and Child Care, sees Freud popping up again and again, not in Freud's words or with labeled Freud. They're the more positive things that you get out of Freud. Freud was interested in where is the origin of neuroses. I was interested in the other side of it, how do children grow emotionally, and I think Freud has given us very good explanation of the stages of development. But it took me 10 years before I could reconcile my Freudian concepts with what mothers were telling me. My Freudian training didn't tell me, it told me that sometimes you get into terrible conflicts with a child over toilet training. But when I asked my psychoanalytic colleagues, well, when should you start toilet training, they shrugged their shoulders because, of course, they didn't know. They only knew the sour side of it. So I had to work out with the help of dozens and dozens of mothers. What is the application? I'd give them the best advice I could on the basis of my theoretical background, and then the next time they'd bring the baby in a month later, I'd say, how did it work? And I was constantly having to revise my idea of what is the practical thing to tell parents and what is the relationship between that and theory. This was shown by the fact that 5 years after I started practice, Doubleday, the publisher, came to me and said, we would like you to write a book on child care. This wasn't because I was well known, I was completely unknown, but they had asked questions around in New York and found that I was the only pediatrician with some training. I told them, I don't know enough. I was not being modest or falsely modest. I really didn't know enough of the answers. Pocketbooks came 10 years after I started practice. The editor there said, he was a droll fellow, he said, it doesn't have to be a very good book, he said. At 25 cents a copy, we are going to be able to sell 100,000 a year. Well, I wasn't insulted at all. I think, first of all, the idea of reaching 100,000 people per year, that seemed very worthwhile to me. It was basically a do-gooder. I think that the other thing that was that I was a perfectionist, and if he said, we want this to be the best damn book that's ever been written, I would have said, I'm not sure that I could deliver that. But if he says, doesn't matter, I said, sure, I'll go ahead and try. In other words, after 10 years, I thought I'd made enough connections between theory and practice, so I went ahead and wrote it. And
how many lives, this is the incredible thing, how many lives have you touched with that book?
I don't know. There are all kinds of scary things if you want to raise questions like that. There were some very simple ones when it was first about to be published. I worried about how many children it would kill, you know, how many. Not because it gave definitely the wrong advice, but any kind of advice can be misunderstood. And I was always trying to lean in the direction of reassuring parents. The easiest thing in the world for a doctor or for a doctor writing a book is to scare the bejeebers out of people. And the previous books on child care all were along the general lines. Look out, stupid, if you don't do exactly what I say, you'll kill your child or at least make your child very sick. I was leaning over backwards always to be reassuring, but there's dangers in being too reassuring. A lot of parents are too anxious with the first child, but by the time they have the third, they're remarkably casual. Some of them, I was scared. Anyway, I was very pleased that after 30 million copies have been sold and used, that nobody's accused me of having killed their child. The accusations that it corrupts youth, that didn't come until 22 years after it was published, and that came as a reaction to my opposition to the war in Vietnam. I think that it was a purely political accusation.
Well, wasn't it one of the presidents who said that we wouldn't have these demonstrations in the street if Spock hadn't have damaged a generation of children?
One of the worst accusers, the man who went all over the United States, was Spiro Agnew. You remember that guy? He turned out to be a common crook, and he had the nerve to tell the American people that I'd corrupted the youth.
Well, several people did argue that you offered more permissive practices of child rearing, and that created a more anti-authoritarian generation that questioned more, that rebelled against authority more, and that this was part of the reason for the flower children in the 1960s, the anti-war movement, the feminist movement, and all of these different movements.
I get stopped on city streets and in airports by people who come up, recognize me, and thank me for writing the book that helped them raise two fine children. And then they often add, and I don't see that it's permissive. And I say, that's right. It isn't permissive. I'm incapable of giving permissive advice. If by permissive you mean let them have anything they want and let them do anything they want. I very much like children and who are polite, who are cooperative, and I raised my own that way. When my sons are interviewed by the press, of course, the poor things are always asked, now, what was it like being a child of your father? And they both sober up right away and say, oh, he was a stern father. Mm. No, I think it was, if by permissive you mean understand what motivates children and try to use that motivation to help them to grow up, to become more mature, more responsible, it's permissive in this sense. But not in the sense that most people use it, which means brats. Simply, it means brats.
Let it all hang out.
Let it hang out. And, now, I think that if you want to be serious about it, I think I might have had just a little bit to do with the independence of those anti-war young people during the Vietnam War period, because, you see, what I was saying to parents is you don't have to grab your child from birth and begin molding him sternly right from the beginning. Children want more than anything else in the world to grow up. That's why they practice adult activities all day long. They're trying to grow up and be more like their parents. And your job is to guide them because they're inexperienced and they're impulsive, but they will do 9/10 of the work. And I think what it did was relax parents and get them to feel, well, the child in general is going to try to turn out well if we do a reasonably good job. And to put it another way, I think parents didn't have to coerce their children or more specifically intimidate their children. I was constantly intimidated by my mother, who made me feel guilty. When I used to come home from school or come in from playing, I cringed as I came in the house. What will my mother scold me about? What have I done wrong? I hadn't done anything wrong, but I always felt as if I'd done wrong. Well, I think that my book helped parents not to intimidate their children. And the result was children, when they grew up to be youths and decided that the war was an entirely wrong war, unconstitutional, illegal, full of war crimes, they had perfect confidence in just making that decision for themselves. I found it to my own distress when I was a professor at the Western Reserve Medical School a couple of years before I had to retire for age. I tried to intimidate the first year class because a third of the class was coming late This was inconceivable at the time that I went to medical school. I tried several occasions to intimidate them. I finally thundered at them a little, and I said, I meant it last 2 weeks ago when I said, please come on time or don't come at all. I raised goose flesh on my own spine, because it's so unseemly for a professor to be thundering at students. And it scared me to hear myself doing it. It didn't scare them at all. Just as many came late, just as many brought coffee, just as many slumped down during the lecture, sipping their coffee. You can't intimidate them.
Those were Spockian kids?
Yeah, I didn't intend it that way, but that's the way it worked out.
Dr. Spock, yeah.
But I think considering the terrible state of the country and the terrible state of the world, I think it's great that there are young people who can't be intimidated, can't be made compliant. I think the only thing that I feel badly about is that spirit of independence didn't last, you know. I ask teachers in high schools and in colleges now, what are your students like? And they said, all very docile,
conforming.
Yeah. They just want to get good grades and go on and get a good job. So obviously I didn't make any deep dent in the young. Another reason for not accusing me of corrupting a whole generation was that all the conservative youths that did go to Vietnam and never protested, they were raised by my book, too. So it's...
Dr. Spock, some people have claimed that you change radically your child-rearing methods and theories over the years. Is this true, or have you basically stuck to the same principles?
That was a complete misunderstanding. A press report went out from Red Book magazine boosting one of my articles, and it was poorly expressed and it was misinterpreted, especially by those people who assumed that I was a permissivist, that I'd turned against permissiveness. I never was a permissivist and I never turned against it, though I've changed my mind about how to help mothers breastfeed and about inoculations and things like that, and those have gone into the revisions. And I've also tried to get rid of the sexism that was part of the book in the beginning. I never have changed my basic feeling that children are very decent people to start with, that they are trying to become more mature, and that the parents' job is to give them guidance, to give them respect, but to ask for respect from them. I mean, this is where parents, some parents have gotten into trouble. They're so ashamed of the abuse of children and the oppression of children in past periods that they've jumped to the opposite extreme and have the feeling parents are apt to do the wrong thing, children are right, and they almost become apologetic to their children or submissive to their children. Respect children, but ask for respect from them, and that's the hard thing for many people to do.
Well, Dr. Spock, during the 1950s, you became a household word in America because of your child-caring and rearing techniques. Then suddenly you became a political figure during the 1960s. The beginning of this was your entrance into SANE, was it not? What led you to become concerned about nuclear weapons and to join that group that was opposing?
It was purely a pediatric issue as far as I was concerned. The director of SANE had twice invited me to join in the previous 3 years, and I told him, no, I don't know anything about fallout. I've always been a reassurer of parents. I don't want to start in scaring parents about radiation. He very smartly came back a third time and said he still thought that I ought to be part of the committee. And I was finally convinced that if we don't have a test ban treaty, and that was the issue that SANE was particularly concerned about then, test ban treaty to be negotiated between the United States and the Soviet Union. If we don't have that, more and more children around the world will die of cancer and leukemia or be born with mental and physical defects as a result of fallout, radiation from fallout. So I joined SANE, became co-chairman a year later, and had to become a spokesman for disarmament. But I saw it as a pediatric issue.
Well, wasn't the medical evidence accumulating during that period that indeed the fallout from the tests were causing cancer? Barry Commoner wrote a book in, I think, 1959, Science and Common Sense, that documented this in a popular way.
Right. As the years have gone by, the experts on radiation have kept having to revise their standards. down and down in the sense of finding that less and less radiation is harmful to human beings. And they've come to the conclusion there is no amount of radiation so small that it doesn't affect at least a few individuals. And that's why I've become not only an opponent of nuclear weapons, but of nuclear power too. We still can't say that it's safe to allow nuclear power plants to exist and to be leaking very small amounts of radiation constantly, and that's what they're all doing.
Well, Dr. Spock, it was quite a jump then, just from that medical aspect to being anti-war in the Vietnam era. What caused you to jump that?
The link there was that I joined SANE in 62, and in 64 I was asked by Lyndon Johnson's campaign committee to support him on radio and television. And I said I certainly would, because Lyndon Johnson promised in that campaign he would not send American boys to fight in an Asian war. Those were his words. Whereas Barry Goldwater was threatening destruction of Vietnam, just wipe it off the face of the earth. So I said, certainly I'll support him as a citizen and as a pediatrician and as a spokesman for the disarmament movement. And I did enough so that he called me up 2 days after the election to thank me. And he said, Dr. Spock, I hope I prove worthy of your trust. And I had no idea. I had no idea that he'd prove utterly unworthy of my trust as far as Vietnam was concerned. And I can still remember saying, oh, President Johnson, of course you'll be worthy of my trust. And he only waited 3 months from November 64 until first week of February 65, when he suddenly started the bombing of North Vietnam and the buildup of fighting troops that eventually reached 500,000. I was horrified and I was outraged, and this was I became more and more active, accepted more and more invitations to speak against the war, which I saw as totally abominable in every way. There was no redeeming feature to it at all.
Well, was there something big that happened? There's another big bridge to cross from disagreement to active opposition, and particularly civil disobedience. Was there something dramatic that happened, or was it just a gradual escalation?
Well, in one sense, it was a gradual escalation. I think that certainly Lyndon Johnson starting the bombing was the first shock and outrage that I got that precipitated me into much more action. And then 3 years later, four other people, including the chaplain of Yale University, were indicted by the Johnson administration, they said, for conspiracy to counsel, aid, and abet resistance to the military draft. I was just trying to stop the war in Vietnam by telling the American people, work against it. Tell the president, tell your senators, tell your congressmen. We were tried, we were convicted, we were sentenced to 2 years in jail. Fortunately, a year later, the Federal Court of Appeals reversed the decision, so I didn't have to serve any time on that rap. Though I did, for the first time in my life, experience the inside of a jail. I spent a night in jail six or eight times as a result of civil disobedient demonstrations. Now, when I first heard of civil disobedience as a weapon to use against the war, it scared me. I was brought up to be extremely law-abiding. As a child, I was terrified of the cop on the block, though I never did anything wrong. I never dared ride my bike on the sidewalk. I never dared go out on Halloween. So it was really a tremendous distance for me to commit civil disobedience. Even to be in demonstrations was very embarrassing at first. I cringed, and when reporters would come up and shove a microphone in my face and say, have you been protesting against what the Soviet Union has been doing? And when I heard about other people committing civil disobedience, I'd get goose flesh right away and think, that's not for me. That may be counterproductive. But as the years of opposing the war went on and I saw that civil disobedience was drawing attention to the outrage, was convincing a lot of people that it was the wrong war, I was willing to do civil disobedience also. But I must say it was painful the first couple of times.
What are some of the forms of civil disobedience? What was your first act of civil disobedience? What are some of the other
Sitting
acts?
Down in New York City on the steps of the induction center. It was purely symbolic. We got together with the police department beforehand, and we had a talk with the mayor about it, and it was all agreed that it was purely symbolic. And there were about 2,000 demonstrators in New York City that morning, 5 o'clock in the morning. If you're going to be there when the inductees come in, it's 5 o'clock in the morning. It wasn't even light yet. I can still remember how scary it was. There were 5,000 cops there surrounding the induction center and 2,000 well-intentioned demonstrators. And I could tell you a long story about trying to climb over the barricades, trying to crawl under the barricades, finally finding a chink in the barricades to get in and just sit down on the steps of the induction center. It was symbolic obstruction to the
war machine.
To the war machine. And then the cop comes up and says, if you don't remove yourself, I'll arrest you. And you pretend you don't hear, and he just takes you by the elbow and escorts you to the paddy wagon, and off you go to jail. And it's the boredom of jail, hour after hour after hour. Nothing to read, nothing to do, just a frozen salami sandwich to eat after you've been there about 8 or 10 hours. It's not a terrible suffering to spend the night in jail, but I often wonder how anybody could stand it for a week, let alone a year or 10 years.
You had you made attempts to get through to and talk with LBJ again, did you not, either orally or in writing, and also Humphrey also, did you not?
I wrote many letters to Johnson pointing out not only that the war was wrong from every point of view, but that it was unwinnable. I think I had a bit of a nerve to be so absolutely sure it was unwinnable. I said it was unwinnable because the French had found it unwinnable. They tried to fight the Vietnamese for 8 years and were ignominiously defeated, and I thought that probably pointed the finger toward us, too. Well, I wrote letters accusing him of not only illegalities and authorizing war crimes, but also telling him, if you go on with this, the American people will turn more and more against it, and you'll end up by turning the country over to the Republicans. I thought that would get to him, even if the illegalities didn't.
How did he respond to any of these letters?
The trouble was, of course, that an assistant would always answer, most often McGeorge Bundy, who was a pretty high assistant.
Yes.
And I think the president would have done well to leave my letters unanswered, because the letters from McGeorge Bundy were the most condescending and therefore the most irritating letters that I've ever gotten in my life. General spirit of all of them was, my dear doctor, you may be sure we've thought of what you're talking about, but we found that it's without merit, yours sincerely. And I'd sit down and write another letter to the president. And finally, I wrote one with an enclosed note to Jack Valenti, who was one of his assistants, saying, Mr. Valenti, will you put this letter on his desk so that if he wants to, he can read it? I want to know that the president knows how I feel about what he did to the people who voted for him as the peace candidate. That did it. I got a note from the president himself. I'd accused him of 10 crimes, and one of them I didn't have solid ground, and he picked up that 10th one.
That's
and was able
the non-winnable
to
one.
Not the non-winnable one, because he couldn't prove that it was winnable, but I said that he sprung that on the country by bombing North Vietnam.
Oh, that's right.
And he pointed out that he'd threatened retaliation both at the Associated Press convention in April of 64, and that in the Tonkin Gulf resolution of the summer of 64 that he'd threatened retaliation. So he had me. I was a little bit embarrassed to have overreached myself in the accusations, but I noticed that he didn't touch the other 2-6.
Go ahead. Well, what about Hubert Humphrey? It looked like there was a chance that he would have the opportunity to wind down the war, but he didn't. What kind of a person was he not to?
Well, I, of course, thought that Hubert Humphrey, who I'd always believed was fairly strong liberal, would be opposed to the war. And after I couldn't get to the president with my letters, I wrote to Hubert Humphrey, that I'd met on a number of times in the past, sort of hinting around that wasn't it terrible what the president was doing to himself, to the American people, and to the Democratic Party. And I was rather shocked. I think he would have done better not to answer my letter. Of course, he couldn't say, "Spock, you're right, Lyndon Johnson is wrong," but he could have at least said, "I can understand your distress," or something like that. But he wrote me back a total justification for the war, and this was quite a shock to me, because in a mild way, he was a hero of mine.
What was his relationship with Johnson? Was he under such control or intimidation by Johnson that he couldn't break out later when he was running?
Well, I thought that was the strangest thing about Humphrey of all. In the first place, Johnson had to give up the presidency. He had to say, "I will not run again." He didn't say, "because I've made a mess of Vietnam," but he said to reunite the American people behind the government. And then he anointed Hubert Humphrey to be his successor and to have the nomination. And then this incredible business of insisting that Hubert Humphrey run on the total support of the war in Vietnam that had already destroyed Johnson. I thought extraordinary that Johnson asked him to run on the same Vietnam platform, and I thought extraordinary that Hubert Humphrey agreed to do so, because he broke out of the traces just a little bit, and his popularity began coming up, but it wasn't enough to prevent the election of Nixon.
Didn't you also get involved in politics with different groups? And I even remember seeing you on television talking about running in a presidential election. Could you say a few words about that, of how that related to some of your anti-war activities?
Well, you see, I'd been a liberal Democrat from the time I was in medical school until the Vietnam War began, but those experiences radicalized me. I realized our government and its foreign policy is more often than not aggressive, that it's trying to extend the power of our armed services, or trying to extend the markets of our industries. In other words, it's the government is not working as much for the welfare of the American people as it's working for industry and for its own power. So I became a radical, and I became a socialist. And then in 1971, a number of small socialist groups in different parts of the country, most notably the Peace and Freedom Party in California, got together. There were about 10 or 12 local parties. There was one in Texas, Florida. There was the Human Rights Party in Michigan. There was the party in Washington, D.C., the States Rights Party in Washington, D.C. They all got together, decided to be an association, and then to form a national party and to run a national candidate. And I was the candidate. People say, "Why did you run?" I didn't particularly want to run. I mean, it was not my picture of myself. But there was a strong sentiment, obviously, because I was well known. And a party that doesn't have any members to start with, and that doesn't have any money to start with, and that doesn't have any prospect of getting any money, it needs something. So they wanted a candidate who was known, so I consented. It was very educational. We got about 80,000 votes, but we'd only gotten on the ballot in 10 states. It's called the People's Party. I campaigned all over the United States at my own expense.
This was 1972.
This was the 72 campaign.
Right.
And I had good-sized audiences, usually at universities. One of the things I realized was how far Americans are from really considering socialism. In fact, as you know, most Americans are scared to death of the word socialism. It immediately conjures up pictures of secret police and destruction of churches and trying to conquer the world. because all that socialism means is producing things for the benefit of people rather than for profit. And I think it's a perfectly reasonable and a gentle philosophy. And our party was strongly democratic in the sense that we believed it should be brought in through the democratic process and that it must stay democratic, be controlled by the people after it was in. I'd speak to an enthusiastic audience, and then always, you know, a couple of dozen people come up on the platform. And one of the things that I'd been talking about the whole hour of talk and a whole hour of answering questions was, don't worry about whether you're voting for Democrats or Republicans. Both of them are controlled by industry. The personalities are different. Nixon is different from McGovern, but the policies that you'll get will be exactly the same. Always one of the people who was up on the platform. This happened every single night for a year, and it was terribly discouraging, the repetition. They'd say, great speech. You got me convinced we've got to have a different economic system. But of course I can't vote for you because I wouldn't want to waste my vote. What's the use of putting in 2 hours on that theme and have it absolutely clear that he's missed the point altogether? Of course, what it really amounts to is, especially with undergraduates, they're pretty strongly identified with the system, and though there may be a little recession here or a big depression there, I think they, in general in America, have confidence that they're going to be able to make out all right. And I think it's simply a statement. Socialism sounds fairer, sounds sort of nice, but don't ask me to give up my stake in the present economy because I expect to do quite well.
Well, they said to you and a lot of people during the 60s and early 70s, now you got to work within the system, Dr. Mm-hmm. Spock.
Yeah.
You know, don't go outside the system, but is it even possible to work within the system and make any meaningful change?
Well, I think that the power is, of course, all on the part of the establishment and on the part of industry and on the part of the government, and that people who have any strong protest have an uphill fight. It certainly was an uphill fight to try to win a majority of the American people over to opposition to the war in Vietnam, though it was done in the end. I always worked within the system. I wrote letters to every politician that was supposed to represent me. I participated in political campaigns, always voted. I wrote letters to the paper. I went to peaceful demonstrations, but I think after you find that the press is paying no attention to you, which is true, I mean, you could have maybe one demonstration that was peaceful, the press would report it, but after you've had the third or the fourth or the fifth, they get bored. They say that's not news, that a few thousand people are shuffling around the White House again. There's no question about it that civil disobedience dramatizes your opposition. It's saying, I feel so strongly that the government is wrong that I'm willing to go to jail if necessary in order to make this point. And you do reach people that way, so the press suddenly pays attention. Just a year ago, I and my wife and about 10 other people from the health professions demonstrated at the White House. We knelt down on the White House lawn to pray, and that's against the law. And we were protesting against cuts in health services by the Reagan administration. And of course, we were immediately arrested. But both Washington papers had half a page on it with pictures, and Newsweek magazine had a quarter of a page on it. I wouldn't do it foolishly or in a foolhardy way, but there's no question that it's a way of bringing the issue to the people.
Dr. Spock, in your travels, particularly in the last 10 years when you've been working with these anti-nuclear groups and other political groups, do you see more of a consciousness that the political problems of America are not just single issues like, for instance, ending the Vietnam War, ending nuclear energy, but there's more radical systemic changes that need to be brought about? Do you think more and more people are beginning to see this, or are most of these political groups just focused on this one issue?
Well, I think the traditional parties get concerned about relatively secondary issues, like should you decrease the budget or should you increase the budget and things like that. My feeling is, of course, that the very fundamental changes have got to be made, that we've got to have a less competitive, more cooperative society. And I think there's a growing number of people who feel that way. But what discourages me is that we have to have either a terrible war like the war in Vietnam to make the American people wake up that something fundamental is wrong, or we have to have an administration like the Reagan administration is getting into what I call an insane acceleration of the arms race and hurting the American people, especially poor people, disadvantaged people, by cutting down on health services, cutting down on educational services, welfare services, housing. All the things that I think are important for people are being impaired. It's too bad that you have to have a war in Vietnam or a policy as drastically wrong as I considered Reagan's policy before any substantial number of people wake up, and at least wake up enough to become active in any way. I think we've got some kind of a tradition in this country of indifference to the political process. I think a lot of Americans say, listen, politics is a dirty business. Don't pay any attention. Your job is to go out and get a good job and get ahead in the world. No, I think everybody's job is to get a good job. I also think that everything's got to be argued on the political stage also.
Do you see a third party as the vehicle for the sort of change that you're talking about? Are there any third parties like the Citizens Party today that you're impressed with?
Well, I think sooner or later, from my point of view, there's got to be a strong third party, and people to the left end of the spectrum have got to get together behind it. But I don't see any... The number are increasing, but I don't think that it's a very substantial number yet. I have hopes, and I'll continue to work, as long as I can stay upright. I'll keep on working for change.
And that brings us to the end of this Alternative Views. Frequently hear from viewers who request a list of news publications which we use on Alternative Views, and also a reading list for U.S. power structure in the mass media. If you would like to have these, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. You must send a self-addressed stamped envelope. There are a lot of people we need to thank for helping with the production, making it possible. Kevin West was the camera person for our news. David Galasich was the director of the interview. Mark Zufelt was the one who set up the interview with Dr. Spock and produced it. Bill Crawford was a sound man. Roxanne Elder of the Mobilization for Survival made the arrangements with Dr. Spock. Alternative Views is a production of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. Goodbye.